We've seen time and time again over the last 30 or 40 years, new technologies come in and fundamentally disrupt traditional markets. We've seen Amazon, we've seen Hulu, we've seen a million examples of this. And so it fits a framework we've seen pay off as an investor.
All right, folks, we are here today with Mr. Matt Hogan, CIO of Bitwise Asset Management, also an advisor at Blockworks, and as one LinkedIn recommendation gave him in 2015, a quote-unquote genuinely likable person and human being. So today we're going to get into ETFs, RIAs, financial advisors, DeFi, all that kind of fun stuff. But before we do that, quick shout-out to our sponsors, Luca and Exodus. More about them in the show notes. Also, Blockworks' flagship summit is back, the Digital Asset Summit, September 14th and 15th. Really excited to bring it back. You can head over to our website, blockworks.co, use code EMPIRE for 10% off. All right, Mr. Matt Hogan, let's get into it, my friend.
I love it. Thanks for having me on. Excited to be here. And of course, excited to be at the DAS Summit later in September.
Amazing. Amazing. So Matt, I think first, I want to start with ETFs. You were a complete pioneer in the ETF industry. And I was looking back at ETF articles from mainstream media, right? The folks that a lot of crypto people kind of rag on sometimes. And I found an article in the Financial Times. They called ETFs weapons of mass destruction. And I wanted to just ask you, what are the comparisons, or do you see any comparisons with how mainstream media treated ETFs back then to how the mainstream media treats crypto today?
Oh, it's a great question. The answer is it's almost identical. I mean, it's stunning. Today, people think of ETFs as these beautiful sort of core parts of everyone's portfolio, the sort of mother's milk of investing. But back in the early 2000s, when I was starting in the ETF industry, people hated them. As you mentioned, the Financial Times called them weapons of mass destruction. If you Googled more, you would find words like liquidity doom loop, and whether ETFs could take down the U.S. bond market. You might have found the time the U.S. Congress had hearings and dragged ETF executives in front of it and asked them if ETFs were destroying the American entrepreneurial dream. There was also times where ETFs were blamed for rising oil prices, as if this little subsector of the economy could influence the largest commodity in the world. They were hated. They were misunderstood. People didn't even know that it was an ETF. For a long time, everyone called them EFTs, and there's just a generalized confusion. Now, what I saw over time was two things, which I think are important for crypto people to remember. Over time, it got better, right? ETFs now are considered mainstream. They're just the way things happen. They're the core of everyone's portfolio. So you can have a financial asset that makes a transition from hated skepticism too mainstream. But the other thing, which I think this will resonate with people who have been in the crypto industry for a while, is that the FUD never fully goes away. As recently as a year ago, I was on a call with a reporter about this idea of ETFs destroying the bond market. The FUD persists with any new technology much longer than you would expect. So I think in the crypto industry, we're tired of talking about environmental FUD. We're tired about talking about tulip bulbs. We're tired of talking about Tether. You should expect those things to persist longer than you think they should. And that doesn't mean that we're not making progress, because we are. And I see the progress we're making on the crypto side in the mainstream media today.
So what does an ETF actually do for an industry?
What is an ETF?
In terms of, you know, in terms of institutional inflow, and I think there's a lot of hype around from, you know, crypto folks like, oh my God, we can't wait for an ETF. But in like on the ground, what actually happens and how big of a change and disruption is an ETF for an industry?
Yeah, I think it's a big deal, but I think it takes longer than people expect. It does two things which people should be really excited about. One, it collapses the cost of accessing the market for most people. It's still too expensive for many people to buy even Bitcoin, much less other assets. ETFs are great at collapsing costs. So I think industry-wide, it's going to bring down the cost of accessing that market. That's going to be good. I guess it does three things. It brings into the market an entire new class of investors who simply won't invest without a vehicle that fits into their workflow. And these are, of course, financial advisors. Financial advisors are the people who manage the wealth for wealthy Americans and wealthy people around the world. They control a huge amount of wealth. Most estimates say they control about 40% of all the wealth in America, as much wealth as the institutional market. So this is a massive market. And while some of them will allocate to crypto or another asset without an ETF that fits into their workflow, most of them won't. And I know this because we have a perfect example, which is gold has been something that people have talked about investing for thousands of years. And there wasn't a gold ETF until the early 2000s. It wasn't in any financial advisor's portfolio. Most people had a 0% allocation because it was hard to access. Yes, you could go to a gold dealer and buy gold and store it under your bed, just like a financial advisor could tell a client to create a wallet and access Bitcoin. But they're not going to do it until it's easy. And what we saw with gold was that you mainstreamed the asset. It really brought it into the fore. But the third thing I wanted to point out is it takes years. It's not like a step function. It's not like the ETF is approved on day one, and on day two, everyone owns crypto or everyone owns Bitcoin. The impact will be felt over months, over years, maybe over 5 years before it fully enters the mainstream. So I think it's a big deal. I think it's going to bring a huge class of investors into the market. And I think it's going to happen. But it will take a long time for it to have the full effect.
You guys created the first index fund, if I remember that correctly, for crypto. I think it's like the Bitwise 10, if that's the name. What group of folks are sitting on the sideline and won't buy the Bitwise 10 and they're going to wait for an ETF? Like who tangibly comes to you and says, Matt, look, I like crypto. I really get it. I want to buy it, but I can't buy it until I get an ETF. Like who is that buyer?
The answer to that is financial advisors. And here's why. It's a very simple reason why. Look, private funds like the kind that Bitwise offer are great for investors in that it allows you to access, say, our diversified index of the 10 largest crypto assets, right? That's a smart investment for many people who want access to crypto. But if you're a financial advisor who has 100 clients and you want to make a 2 or 5% allocation to the Bitwise 10 across all of those 100 clients, you have to send us 100 different wires. These financial advisors are busy professionals. They don't have time to go to the bank and process 100 wires for clients every time they want to make an allocation to this space. For those advisors, being able to push a button on an ETF and have it populate into all of their client accounts is simply a game changer. They will make the allocation. We have over 250 RIAs who work with us today doing that kind of wiring money in, et cetera, because they are deep believers in crypto. But for most people who just want an allocation to this space, who don't spend 24/7, who aren't reading crypto articles, following the latest regulatory news, you need that ease of use. It's simply a game changer. And so for that market, which is a $20+ trillion market, they're not going to come in until the ETF is there. And we know it because we have a team of 15 salespeople who are talking to these advisors every day. And while some of them will allocate and many of them are excited about crypto, a lot of them say they're going to wait for an ETF. So it is a game changer in that sense.
Is there some element of they can't make money from it, so they don't recommend it with crypto pre-ETFs?
That's definitely a piece of it, right? So the dirty underlying laundry of it is the way financial advisors make money is they have a portfolio management system that lists all of their positions and they take a fee out of the positions, out of the net assets in that system. And when you don't have a product that fits into that software, I know this sounds really prosaic and simple, but these are the things that drive people. When you don't have a product that fits into that software automatically, that plugs into the plumbing, and you don't get paid on it. And so advisors have families to support and college funds to save for and mortgages to pay, and they want to get paid on the assets they're advising on. And an ETF makes it much easier. Now, it is, of course, true. You can get paid on a private fund, but you have to line item it separately in your account reporting. You have to itemize it. It's a big pain. It shouldn't seem like something important as crypto is gated by these practical matters of how hard or easy it is to do something. But they're real frictions, and it's keeping a lot of investors, a lot of advisors out of the market.
So how long do you think until we actually see a Bitcoin ETF?
I think we're getting closer, Jason. I think, you know, if you were to make me guess, I think we're inside of 12 months. But of course, I don't know that. You know, we have seen ETFs in Canada. We've seen ETFs in Switzerland. We've seen ETPs in Germany and Brazil. So I think regulators around the world are increasingly looking at the space and saying it's mature enough for an ETF. And I know, because Bitwise talks to the SEC on a regular basis, that they're investigating this heavily, researching this heavily, taking it very seriously. So I do think we're close. I don't know if we'll get there this year or if it will be next year, but I'd be very surprised if we weren't there by the end of next year. That would be pretty stunning to me.
Is the biggest holdup still the, like, quote unquote, market manipulation and wash trading and things like that? And if so, can you explain that for folks?
Yeah, absolutely. So one thing about ETFs, before an ETF can be approved, you have to be able to surveil the underlying market. That's a rule that's been in the Exchange Act since the first ETF was launched in 1993. So every ETF that has come to market has to pass this hurdle of, can you review what's going on in the underlying market and make sure there's no funny business, there's no market manipulation, or at least if there is, you can prosecute it and investigate it. It's easy for many markets because they fit under a national regulated surveillance mechanism. Like the New York Stock Exchange has surveillance agreements in place with all other exchanges, and they're regulated at a level that makes the SEC comfortable. When you get out of those nationally regulated markets, there are additional burdens. Now, you can clear those burdens. An example is the gold market. Spot gold actually doesn't trade on a regulated market. It trades over the counter on individual agreements. But there's a large regulated futures market that allows for surveillance, that allows you to get a gold ETF into the market. And there are many examples of this. But the SEC wants us to make sure that the underlying Bitcoin markets are not easily manipulated, and that there is a way to surveil it through a nationally regulated market like the CME Bitcoin futures market, which a lot of people are focused on. I do think we will get there. I do think that the math shows that the underlying market is not overly susceptible to manipulation and can in fact be sufficiently surveilled. But it's incumbent on companies like Bitwise and the increasing array of other companies focused on getting an ETF to prove this to the SEC, right? They're telling us this is what you need to show, and we're trying to show it. And I do think someone eventually will get over the edge, and I'm hopeful that it will be Bitwise.
One can hope. One can hope. All right. So, Matt, my co-founder, who obviously you know very well, Mike Ippolito, has just been banging the table saying that folks are underestimating the importance of RIAs and financial advisors. And I think in crypto, the way that folks have always looked at it is, okay, 2015, 2016, 2017, 2018, it's very retail driven. Then you have basically the infrastructure providers come along, institutional custody, institutional lending, institutional borrowing, institutional exchanges, futures market, things like that. This allows the quote-unquote institutional folks to come in. And so now crypto buckets it as retail and institutional. And there's this massive, like, fat middle that people are missing, which is financial advisors and RIAs. So let's zoom all the way out. What is a financial advisor and an RIA? What are those folks? How much money are they controlling? And how important are they to further adoption of crypto?
It's such a great question. They're the key to further adoption of crypto. They're the next group of major investors that are coming into this market. And I think the crypto industry needs to be much more focused on them. So to answer your question, financial advisors writ large are people who manage money for other wealthy individuals or middle-class individuals. Anyone who has a portfolio and doesn't feel comfortable managing it themselves turns to a financial advisor who can help them create a proper portfolio, as well as do all the sort of financial planning that people need to do. How much should you save for college? How much should you save for retirement? How do you optimize your tax situation, et cetera? The incredible thing about how the crypto market has developed, as you mentioned, is that they've overlooked this financial advisor market. And to give you context on how large it is, the retail market that built crypto owns somewhere between 10 and 20% of the wealth in the US. We talk about it a lot in the equity markets, the people who are trading on Charles Schwab, the people who are trading on Robinhood, in the crypto markets, the people who are opening Coinbase or Kraken accounts. But in reality, these people don't have that much money. They tend to be younger individuals with small portfolios. We talk about a lot about the institutional market, pensions, endowments, et cetera. They get headlines. The CIOs are put on CNBC, very concentrated market. They have real money. They control about 40% of the wealth in America. So 40% institutional, 10 to 20% self-directed retail. The rest is all managed by financial advisors. The disconnect that I think people miss is we know that there's a wide degree of income disparity in the US, right? The vast majority of wealth is controlled by a relatively few number of people. That's unfortunate, but it is the reality. All of those wealthy people have their money with a financial advisor. Virtually all of those wealthy people. This market is as big or bigger than the institutional market. And it is the market that built the ETF industry. And these are people who are looking for new ideas. And they're very eager to investigate crypto. And the percentage that's allocating to them is growing over time. I think it's the most important market for crypto to focus on if it wants to open up new capital. It's way more important than retail right now.
My uncle is a financial advisor. He knows slim to nothing about crypto. He is one of the financial advisors who I think has tuned into one of your webinars because I forced him to join it. What's your pitch to a financial advisor? We're going to start talking a little bit about DeFi, but I want to talk just like, what is your general pitch for Bitcoin, crypto, this industry in general? To a financial advisor who is not yet, doesn't even know what blockchain is, maybe.
Right. Oh, that's a great question. Look, my general view on crypto is that you can approach it in one of two ways. And the way you approach it, at least if you're coming from the traditional finance space, determines whether you fall in love with it or you think it's tulip bubbles, rat poison squared, and going to zero. And the fork in that road is, for traditional financial people, if you approach it first as a currency, you're going to end up at the end of the road at rat poison squared. And the reason is even a well-developed crypto asset like Bitcoin is still a pretty janky currency today. It's volatile. You can't spend it many places. It has a long way to go before it looks good from a traditional financial perspective next to a dollar in terms of its utility and the confidence you have in it. So I think people see the word cryptocurrency, they go down that path and they run ashore on the shoals of disaster. The pitch that we give is to stop thinking about it as a currency and start thinking about it as a technology. And if you approach it as a technology, you end up in a very different space, which is a huge degree of confidence that this is going to be not just important, but generationally important. And the kind of examples that I think resonate with people are when you talk about the difference between bank wires and sending money over the Bitcoin network, right? It is still, I think it stops traditional financial professionals in their tracks if you tell them, look, we're talking on a Thursday. If you went to wire money to London from the largest bank in the world, the earliest it would get there would be Monday. That's a bank with hundreds of thousands of employees. Maybe you're in New York and the bank's in London. They have offices in both places, and still it takes them 4 or 5 days to get money abroad. By contrast, you have something like the Bitcoin network where you can send $1 billion and it'll settle in 10 minutes. And that's a software network with zero employees, no CEO, no offices, no internal balance sheet of its own. And yet it can move money not just 10% faster or 100% faster, but something like 1,000,000% faster than the largest bank in the world. When you get them to realize that there is more to this than just a janky currency, when you get them to realize that it's a technology that's going to change the architecture of finance in the future and make it more efficient, more inclusive, more exciting, more effective, then they get interested and they want an allocation. Because these are advisors who have seen that story before, who have seen technologies disrupt other markets, who are investing in things like the ARC funds because they're excited about what technology can do to society. And the proof points on crypto are just undeniable. Speed of settlement, creation of digital property rights, programmability of money. These are big new ideas that they can cotton on to. So that's part of our approach on what crypto is. And then the other piece is their clients are already asking them about it, right? So whether the advisor wants to or not, chances are their retail clients are probably investing already. So they have to learn about it. They have to understand where it fits in an asset allocation framework. And it resonates. I think that message resonates.
We spoke with a large institutional portfolio manager at a university the other day, and he said that in 2017, he brought up Bitcoin to the endowment board. I don't fully know how it works, but like the investment endowment board, and they basically said don't bring this up again. And 4 years later, he hadn't brought it up. And they brought it up and said, why aren't we talking about this? Why aren't we allocating to this? And why aren't we doing this? And so, you know, that's in 4 years might seem like a long time, but man, like 4 years has really flown by. And so I think my question to you is specific to the financial advisor in the RIA space. How much has the conversation changed over the past 4 years?
It's changed dramatically. It's changed dramatically. And I would say, Jason, the thing that has changed, and maybe this changed at this endowment board as well, is that the binary outcome of crypto fizzling and going to zero has largely diminished or gone away from conversations. In 2017, when I would talk to financial advisors, a good portion of them would reflexively dismiss it and assume it's going to zero. And if we're being honest with each other, back in 2017, there were more sort of binary risks in the crypto market that could have, well, I wouldn't say drive it to zero, could have substantially delayed it. There was more regulatory risk, there was more banking risk, et cetera. The change that's happened over the last 4 years is now it's a matter of degree. Like most advisors, 80, 90% will admit that crypto probably has a place in our future. And it's just a question of whether it's 1 to 100. And that's a very different conversation than whether it's 0 to 1. 0 to 1 introduces this idea of like, of terrible outcomes if they make even a small allocation. When you start talking about gradients, it's a much more interesting conversation. So that's been a big change. And then I'll say the other big change over the last year is that we've started talking more about Ethereum. We've started talking more about DeFi. We started talking more about sort of useful applications of crypto beyond digital gold. And 3 or 4 years ago, those conversations were impossible. You really couldn't get past Bitcoin with financial advisors. They hadn't heard of Ethereum, much less other assets. And that is another thing that's changed over the last 4 years. It's very confidence driving for me about how successful crypto will be in this market that we've had those two changes take place.
Before we jump into DeFi, what is the... So a typical financial advisor might have 500 or 100 or 50 clients, right? There's a large spectrum. What is the, if I'm in your shoes, it's kind of a tough job, right? Because you first have to pitch and explain to financial advisors why this whole thing is real. And then you have to arm them with the information to go take it to a large spectrum of clients. So on that second half, what is the best way to help a financial advisor determine how much their client should allocate to the space?
Generally speaking, the advisors we talk to aren't going to make an allocation below 1%. They aren't going to make an allocation below 1% because it's not worth their time monitoring, documenting, talking to clients about it. So 1% is almost the floor. In crypto, at least historically, when you get above 5% of your portfolio, crypto starts being the largest influencer of the maximum drawdown of your portfolio. A little bit CFA hat, so to back up, maximum drawdown is like when your portfolio goes from $100,000 to its worst point before rebounding. Does it go to $90,000? Does it go to $80,000? Does it go to $50,000? Maximum drawdown is a very important thing for financial advisors because it's what people feel in their gut, right? If you look at your retirement portfolio and it's up 3% and the market's up 4%, most people actually don't care. What they care about is if they look at it and, oh, It's down 75%. I'm not going to be able to retire for an extra 4 years. That's what they don't like. And so above 5%, crypto, because it's a volatile asset, becomes the biggest driver of your maximum drawdown. Below 5%, historically, it's been the stocks in your portfolio. So we tell advisors, stick below 5%, because otherwise you're going to have these sort of gut-wrenching conversations on the influence crypto is having on these people's portfolios, and they're probably not ready for it. I have more than 5% of my personal net worth in crypto, obviously, but I'm extremely high conviction, have the ability to take on that risk, and have a very long time horizon. For most of these advisors who are talking to clients, 1% to 5% is the right zone to be in. And for what it's worth, that's what most Bitwise clients are. I'd say the average is about 2.5%, but it spans that 1 to 5 spectrum.
And let's say, okay, so I'm a financial advisor. I say, Matt, you sold me. I'm all in 5%. What's the allocation now from Bitcoin to ETH to, like, how do you actually allocate within that 5%?
Yeah, it's a great question. Most people who work with Bitwise buy our flagship large cap crypto index fund, which holds the 10 largest assets, Bitcoin, ETH, Cardano, et cetera, down to Uniswap. And it's allocated by market cap, effectively by size. So the biggest allocation is to Bitcoin. The next biggest allocation is to Ethereum and on down the spectrum. About 2/3 of the portfolio today is Bitcoin. Another 25% is ETH, and so on, because Bitcoin is by far the largest asset, right? Most people listening can imagine the Bitcoin market share is about 2/3 of the market. The reason that's a good answer for these advisors is that they can't monitor this on a day-to-day basis. So if there's an issue with Ethereum, or if there's something really great with Ethereum, they don't have the ability to jump in and decide should they overweight ETH now or underweight ETH now. If Cardano gets major development activity, they don't have the ability to see that yesterday and make a decision about whether they should allocate more tomorrow. If Elon tweets something about Bitcoin, they can't think about what that should do their Bitcoin allocation. The beauty of this size-based market cap weighted index exposure is that they can just make a bet that crypto will be more important in 3 or 5 years than it is today, and the index will dynamically adjust over time. So that's what most people do. There are an increasing share of advisors who have particular views and want to overweight, make an active bet, say this is going to be more important in the future than it is today. The two things that drive most of those overweights are Ethereum. A lot of excitement about Ethereum. It's easier for people to understand, I think, than Bitcoin. And DeFi, which again, I think people get very excited about being the next big wave. But for most people, they just buy the index, and that's enough. I know that sounds very boring for a lot of crypto native people, just to market cap weight. You don't have opinions, Matt. You don't want to overweight Bitcoin and underweight Litecoin, or you still have Bitcoin Cash in there. But for most advisors, they don't want to be thinking those next level thoughts. This is a very frontier asset class for them. They just want market exposure. And so that's what we've been having success with and pulled in, you know, over $1 billion in assets that way.
Got it. Okay. Now we're going to do a little exercise. I'm going to make you take off your CFA hat, take off your button down shirt, pretend like you just had 3 glasses of wine. We're at a dinner party and you're not talking to financial advisors. You're talking to perhaps a group of 27-year-olds, right? Maybe they worked in consulting for a few years or banking or tech, and like they've got a little excess cash, right? Mm-hmm. They come to you, they say, Matt, I'm 27 years old. I've got $100,000 in cash. I already have some stocks and equities and bonds and things like, probably no bonds, but equities. And they say, what percentage of my portfolio should be in crypto? They say, I like crypto. They say, I kind of get it. I see the future. I don't work in the space, but I've got some excess cash and I'm 27 and I can take a risk. What percentage of their portfolio should be in crypto? And they say they've got a tough stomach.
Right.
And they can live through a 2008 drawdown. Yeah.
And I believe them. I just have one question for them, which is, when are you going to need the money? Are you going to need the money in the next 10 years, Jason?
Nope.
Oh, then I think you can make a substantial bet. I don't think 5% is the cap there. I think it could be 10%. I think it could be more than that if you have the ability to take that risk. I think it could be a quarter of your portfolio or more. It's funny you raised that. You know, the first time, one of the first times that I heard a talk about crypto was from Mark Yusko. And he talked about how the one thing that young people have that older people don't is really long time horizons. You can invest in something today that will matter in 10 years, and that's fine, right? It doesn't matter the path it takes between here and 10 years from now. The thing about crypto that would say to me that those 27-year-olds could put a big chunk of their portfolio in is that I have a really high degree of confidence that 10 years from now, crypto is going to be a huge part of our economy. It's going to be how finance works. And so if you're willing to wait out the interim volatility, great. The reason I didn't say like 100% of your portfolio, Jason, is I don't believe you. No one has that tough a stomach. If you took all your $100,000 and parked it in crypto and we had a 70% drawdown, you're going to throw the next glass of wine at me. So I wouldn't say 100%. but you could do 25. You could do more than that. You could do more than that. Yeah, got but not 100%. Okay. Too much.
Not 100%. Yeah, you don't want someone banging the wine glass over your head. On a Bankless podcast, you said that professional investors get the DeFi pitch much faster than they get Bitcoin or Ethereum, mm-hmm. for that matter. And that's, mm-hmm. you said that's not conjecture. That's just fact. And you are now the fourth asset manager in the last 28 days who I've heard say the same thing. So you also published a paper. You said why Ethereum is the crypto asset of the summer. Can you explain why the Ethereum pitch is and DeFi pitch is landing faster than and easier than the Bitcoin pitch for more traditional investors?
100%. The first thing you're taught when you come into the traditional financial world is that this time is different are the four most expensive words in the English language. This time is different have destroyed so many traditional financial careers, betting that things that have historically been one way are going to phase shift immediately into a new future is just something you're taught to avoid. And when traditional financial investors look at Bitcoin, they see a new global internet currency that fell from the sky and is now worth, you know, $750 billion. And they say, that's different. I've never seen the creation of a new store of value. I've never seen the creation of a new global internet currency. I don't know how this plays out, and it's likely not to. Just because those four words are the most expensive words in the English language, is drilled into your mind. Conversely, when you look at Ethereum or you look at DeFi, what you see is software disrupting a tired industry. You see, as we mentioned, people taking 4 days to wire money abroad and a new architecture doing that instantly. You see things like escrow agents and trust agents that shouldn't exist that can be replaced with smart contracts and executed for free. You see, you know, arbitrage and settlement that takes place instantaneously instead of taking place over multiple days. We've seen time and time again over the last 30 or 40 years, new technologies come in and fundamentally disrupt traditional markets. We've seen Amazon, we've seen Hulu, we've seen a million examples of this. And so it fits a framework we've seen pay off as an investor. And that's the reason that DeFi particularly resonates so clearly. And then the other thing is they look at something like Uniswap. Uniswap didn't exist 3 years ago, is now doing $50 billion in trading volume, and is generating substantial fees. And they see cash flow and they see revenue. And it's so easy to understand cash flow and revenue. It's much easier than understanding an amorphous term like store of value. For what it's worth, you know, many people in the crypto industry don't know this. Huge chunks of the traditional financial industry are skeptical of gold. They think gold is a barbarous relic that's probably worth zero long term. That's not a outside the box view. So people are skeptical of that, but revenue, cash flow, technology, that's been like people my age, I'm 45, that's been our experience for our entire investing career. The last 25 years has been about technologies disrupting tired industries, and we see that happening in finance with DeFi. And that's why it resonates so quickly.
Yeah, I mean, Matt, I completely agree with that. I would also kind of push back and say it's not just 45 years or 25 years, but it's the last 100 years, right? Like the way that we kind of explain DeFi is 1920s. Like it's basically just an improvement on financial architecture. 1920s, you get accounting machines and punch cards. 1950s, you get mainframes. 1970s, you get ATMs and credit cards. Later in the 1970s, you get this like stock market trading pits getting replaced by computers. 1990s, you get the computerization of finance, like bank accounts, stock buying you can do from your couch. 2000s, you get fintechs like TransferWise and PayPal. And this is just an extension of financial architecture improving. And that becomes our explanation of DeFi instead of, hey, there's this thing, Bitcoin. It's a hedge against inflation. Okay, that's interesting. And then, if the US dollar, the value inflates away, it gets devalued. And you start almost like having to put on your tin hat to explain Bitcoin to some folks, whereas DeFi is just a an extension of financial architecture improving. So,
I love that.
yeah, I hear you.
I love that completely. I
I hear
also
you.
think people are viscerally confronting all the time the absurdity of how slow and archaic the traditional financial system still is. I mean, stocks take 2 days to settle. What takes 2 days? Nothing takes 2 days. You can order something from Amazon, it gets here tomorrow. So I think there's like this visceral simmering disappointment in how archaic the traditional financial system still is. We've made some progress, but people see the need for, substantial additional progress. So I love that 100-year story.
Yeah. Matt, I just on a like a very personal note, I have been in the industry for I don't know when you got into crypto, but I've been in it for 6 years now. And when I saw things like SushiSwap and Uniswap and these unicorns and like this goofy branding, I was like, I'm not so sure about this. Right? I don't know if this thing's here to stay. Like, this is pretty goofy. I'm not sure if Blockworks editorial should cover it. Like, I'm not sure if personally it's the real deal. And I'm just wildly impressed that you guys had the conviction to go all in on DeFi. You're the one of the first asset managers to really have that conviction. So, like, can you take us back to when you first started reading about things like Uniswap and Compound and Aave and SushiSwap and like how you actually had the conviction to go all in on DeFi?
I'll admit, like everyone, some of those things and some of the names and some of the brands took a while. And I think even at Bitwise, we talked a lot about whether it's all just circularity within the DeFi system and whether there was any real world application. But at least for me, I can't speak for everyone at Bitwise, at least for me, one way I think about technology is if there are things that shouldn't be true in the world, and they can be fixed, they inevitably will be. An example is that wiring money thing. There are plenty of other examples, things like, how painful it is to go get a loan at the bank. And when we looked at DeFi, there were just very real proof points that this was introducing new things that were extremely valuable. So an example of that proof point is Uniswap. There's obviously real utility. People were using it to trade. We talked to some of the largest hedge funds in the world. They were migrating some of their trading off of centralized exchange into the Uniswap ecosystem. That gave us very real confidence that this was not just circularity, it was here to stay. I personally thought a lot about Aave. Aave's so phenomenal because it takes something that's so painful in the traditional system that shouldn't be painful. Like collateralized loans should be able to be processed instantaneously. The reason they're not in the traditional financial system is we don't have that same speed of settlement. And Aave sort of solves that and allows you to get collateralized loans at the speed at which you should be able to get them because of the underlying architecture of crypto. And another thing that excited me about that is it allows not just an improvement over existing financial services, but an introduction of new financial services that weren't possible without this technology, like flash loans. When you see a technological breakthrough that makes a fundamental improvement on things that shouldn't still be the way they are, you know that long term it's not going to be denied. It'll be messy. And we talk to people about how DeFi will be messy. For what it's worth, Jason, I still think it'll be messy. We're about to enter into a rocky sea of regulation, the outcome of which is uncertain. It's a messy space. But the underlying technological breakthroughs are just unassailable. It's just so much more efficient, so much faster. It solves so many problems. The application into the real world is so obvious and major and near term that we just had a lot of confidence it wasn't going to go away. I think it may help that Bitwise investors tend to be long-term investors, right? We're an index fund shop. The people investing in our products tend to be making 3 to 5 year allocations. And if you talk to people about what will happen in DeFi over the next 3 to 5 months, who knows? Like, huge uncertainty. But you talk to people about what the future of finance will look like 3 to 5 years from now. I think it's hard to reject DeFi. And so that gave us the confidence to go all in. And for what it's worth, it resonated with our traditional financial advisor audience.
For those listening that haven't set up their MetaMask and played around with things like Uniswap and Aave and Compound, can you explain one of these platforms like you're explaining it to a 50-year-old financial advisor? Maybe let's use Aave, for example, or Uniswap, whatever you want to do.
Yeah, I can do both. I'll use Uniswap because it's the largest, and I think there's some nice analogies. Uniswap is just an exchange. It lets you take Ethereum and trade it for another asset in the same way that you would at an exchange like Coinbase, or the same way you would at the New York Stock Exchange, where you might sell your Apple and buy some IBM, right? That's its fundamental underlying service. The differences, and these are really important differences, is that it's decentralized. There's no central entity running it. It's just a software program. And it's a two-sided market. In other words, you, Jason, can also decide to supply liquidity. Let's say you have a lot of Ethereum sitting around. You can agree to trade that Ethereum to another party for another asset at a predefined curve. In the same way, if you had an extra cabin on your lot, wherever you live, you could rent it out on Airbnb, or you could rent somebody else's cabin. It's a two-sided market. Two-sided markets are very important in the internet ecosystem, and you've seen them develop all over the place because you tap into this massive well of supply-side capability into a market that already has demand. So Airbnb is a great example. There's demand to rent vacation properties, but many people didn't have an easy way to rent out their vacation properties. Airbnb introduced that way, and that grew the market exponentially, made it much bigger, made it much more efficient, and we all use it today. Uniswap has a lot of similarities. It allows, in a decentralized fashion, people to be liquidity providers or liquidity takers, and it just works really well. And you know it works really well because it's gone from nothing to being one of the most important exchanges in the crypto ecosystem. Now, it's only within crypto right now. But A, that's a very real market. Look at Coinbase. It IPO'd. It's a huge company. It's going after that same marketplace. And B, it has obvious applications into other markets outside of crypto eventually. And so I think that's a great example. I think it's easy to see. And the proof is in the pudding. You can see the trading volume every single day. You can talk to investors who are trading on Uni instead of on centralized exchanges because they're getting better execution. So that's how I talk about Uniswap with traditional financial.
I was speaking with a CEO and founder of one of the largest centralized exchanges in crypto that everyone would know. And I said, you know, are you like worried about, you know, this competitor? He said, I'm not worried about a single competitor. I'm not worried. I have no worries about its competitors. He said, you know who I'm worried about? Decentralized exchanges. He goes, we are going to get our lunch eaten by decentralized exchanges. He said it's inevitable, right? You look at a company like Coinbase, 1,000 employees raised $500 million. They're now competing with Uniswap, 20 employees raised $20 million, right? 500 million versus 20 million, 1,000 employees versus 20 employees. You know, if this was, I think you might've said this actually, so I'm stealing this quote from probably you. If this were a venture-backed Silicon Valley company, it would be front page on TechCrunch, Wall Street Journal, and Bloomberg every single day. But it's a crypto company, and it's quote-unquote decentralized, so like doesn't really make sense to people. So no one's talking about it.
I think it's the greatest business story of the last 10 years. I think it's truly astounding. And that's exactly right. And I do think whoever you were speaking with, I think they're right. I think it's going to eat their lunch. It's the same thing. You know, go back to that Airbnb example. Oh, that's who hotels are worried about, right? They're not worried about the next hotel chain. They're worried about a fundamental disruption that taps into a two-way market in a decentralized fashion. There's just so much power in that. And you're seeing that in a really, really amazing way with Uniswap. And the same thing is true with Aave. Again, it's solving a very real problem, and it's solving it very elegantly, and it's doing it in a decentralized fashion with none of the overhead of a centralized organization. It has a difficult, rocky regulatory path, or at least some regulatory questions around it in the future, but the underlying advance is undeniable and very real. I think it's amazing.
I'm going to push back on the regulatory side in a second, though I know you're 10 times smarter than me on that side of things and on most things. But first, I want you to explain what Aave is for folks who have never used it.
Yeah, sure. Aave is a way to get a collateralized loan in crypto.
So for like, let's go way higher. Like what is collateralized versus over collateralized, under collateralized? Like what is a collateralized loan?
Sure. Jason, if I wanted to borrow $100 from you, you could just give it to me because I'm a nice guy and you know me, and you could probably find out where I live and come, you know, get it from me. But that's a pain. So often in lending, there's a concept of collateral, which is that an asset that the lender has access to that backs up a loan beyond your good faith and credit in me as an individual. So something that people are familiar with, people often have loans out when they buy a house. The house is the collateral for that loan. The bank makes you a loan. They give you money to buy that house. If you don't repay that loan, the bank will seize your house, sell it, and therefore not lose money on the loan. That's a collateralized loan. A fully collateralized loan, which is the example in Aave. Let's say that I have Ethereum and I want to buy an additional crypto asset with it, whatever crypto asset you want. I want to buy some Uniswap or some Aave. You could give me a loan of that Uniswap or Aave collateralized by my position in Ethereum. And then if, let's say, I get the uni and it drops in value, you could effectively seize my Ethereum to make yourself whole. And Aave is a service that allows you to make these sort of collateralized and over-collateralized loan. There are a few elegant pieces to it, including that your loan positions are not collateralized on a one-on-one basis, like Ethereum versus uni. They're collateralized across your entire wallet. And also, similar to Uniswap, it's a two-sided market. So if I want to lend out my crypto assets, I can do that and earn income from you because you're going to pay me an interest rate to borrow those assets from me. And this is a huge market. And the beauty of the system is these loans can be processed automatically because crypto has settlement finality, which allows this collateralization to be prosecuted immediately if the value of an asset dips and you're under collateralized. So this is a big market in traditional financial services for what it's worth. Prime brokers provide this service to hedge funds and other major investors all the time. They have a position, they want to take on leverage, they get a loan, it's collateralized at the prime broker with another position, and they go off and do their things in the market. So this is a big chunk of the traditional financial services market that's being replicated, retailized, and distributed in crypto through platforms like Aave in a really efficient manner. And again, it taps into this two-sided nature of the market in that there are a lot of people that say have a long position in crypto for the next 10 years who would love to earn interest on it. And they're able to earn interest by lending it to people who maybe have a shorter term view on a particular asset and want a loan. And so it works out on both sides. It grows the market. It's very efficient. And a lot of people, you know, have been using it. It's a beautiful protocol.
I just got a mortgage at Wells Fargo, and it took like 95 days to get the mortgage processed. How long does a loan take to get processed on Aave?
Yeah, shorter than you were just talking. That's the amazing thing. These loans can be processed basically instantaneously versus your experience at Wells Fargo, which is so painful. And it removes all the steps that you're papering over in the Wells Fargo example, where you went and got title insurance and you had an escrow agent and you had to get all these documents notarized and these sorts of things. Because of the way crypto works, because you have settlement finality, you can process all those steps immediately. That's another example of how archaic our financial system is. Think about that, 95 days. And when you extrapolate that into the real world, you know, if you had a tokenized version of your house, there's no reason you couldn't get a home equity loan on that instantaneously either. So you can easily see how this expands into the real world once you have that settlement finality of financial assets that allows transactions to settle immediately. You can collapse that 95 days into, 95 seconds if you do it properly.
Over-collateralized loans make a lot of sense, right? Especially in a world where, like, there's no credit checks. Like, you don't know how risky I am. As you know, I could easily default on it. So over-collateralized loans make a lot of sense. How do we get to a world of under-collateralized loans when there are no such things as credit checks and you don't actually know how risky I am as a borrower?
Yeah, I think that's a big challenge. I think that's one that people are working on. I don't think they're transparent solutions that are at least near term. I think people will experiment with it and there'll be a lot of failures. But ultimately, I think there's probably a way to get there. There's so much more data available to lenders in real time than they're making use of today, that I think you can imagine a world where they get to those under-collateralized lending platforms with something that's a better proxy than credit scores. But I do think that's still a little ways away. It's a holy grail, but it's a little ways away. And importantly, you know, I do see that story in the media a lot, that what's the use of collateral? Collateralized loans are a huge piece of the traditional financial architecture. This is a huge multi-billion dollar market. It's not like a new idea. It's a big market. And even if that's all we penetrate, it's a huge market. I do think we'll get to traditional lending eventually, but there are a lot of steps between here and there. And I think there'll be a lot of failures for what it's worth. I think that's a risky, difficult step to make, but I do think we'll eventually make it. I just think it'll take a little bit of time.
There's a fascinating kind of thing that played out with Uniswap the other day, where mm-hmm. the front end of Uniswap, the Uniswap platform, delisted the tokens, but the back end protocol didn't have to delist the tokens, right? So what's the you've mentioned the regulatory risk three different times now in this podcast. It seems like it's top of mind. Why is it so top of mind for you?
It's top of mind because every U.S. regulatory agency, by which I mean everyone in the financial space, the SEC, the CFTC, the IRS, the Consumer Protection Financial Board, the Treasury Department, the House of Representatives, Congress, the White House, the OCC, there's so many acronyms that it makes your head spin, Jason. Every single one over the last 3 months have announced plans to create a architecture for crypto regulation, targeting in part the DeFi space, and maybe particularly the DeFi space if you include stablecoins within the DeFi space. The reason I say it's a risk is because regulations are made by humans, and regulations are way behind on crypto. So, you know, most federal securities laws are based on decisions made 80, 90 years ago, and applying those to a world of decentralized assets and hypothetical securities and those sorts of things is a real challenge. And so whether they get it right is a pregnant question. I do think I'm actually net optimistic. Even if they get it ballpark right, even anything but crushing regulatory overreach, I think unleashes one of the greatest bull markets in crypto that we've ever seen in the DeFi space. There's a huge amount of regulatory paranoia from smart money in DeFi that I think has been priced into the market because there is so much regulatory uncertainty of how we're going to escape from here. And I actually think regulators will look to unleash the positive aspects of the DeFi market and we'll end up in a good place. But there's a non-zero chance that we don't. And that's why I was raising it for people. I think it's both the number one catalyst for the next DeFi bull market and the number one risk to a DeFi winter. And I think the outcome is uncertain.
My thesis for how this plays out is that the front ends of all of these platforms will end up getting regulated. So the front ends will feel like when there's a company that manages the front end, it'll be no different than a centralized company like a Coinbase or a BlockFi. But the back ends are impossible to actually shut down and regulate unless, right, like this is the black swan event, like the regulators put into the regulation that the developers can't write smart contract code, which would be a completely, you know, That would be probably end up being a Supreme Court freedom of speech case. So it seems like where this play, where we go here is that the front end gets regulated, the back end can't get regulated, and the back end will be run by basically DAOs, decentralized autonomous organizations, and companies like Shapeshift that are moving, that are no longer companies, they're becoming DAOs. The DAOs are plugged into the back end DEXs. That's where you, it, I find it very tough to regulate something like a DAO that is completely plugged into, you know, Matcha or Uniswap on the back end.
I actually agree with that. And I do think trying to regulate those would introduce significant freedom of speech issues that I think would run a shoal ultimately legally. But that headline would still be a major issue in the crypto market, right? Like if regulators did decide to go after the underlying protocols themselves or the developers of those protocols. And I do think the front ends are going to be materially changed. You know, I think the front ends, you're going to see significant steps. I think Uniswap was just the first example, or maybe one of the first examples, but you're going to see that across the board. And, you know, I think there's non-zero risk. If the front ends don't adjust enough, you could see pressure on centralized exchanges to delist tokens or things like that that could have significant impacts in the ecosystem. So I agree that yours is the base case. And it's a case that I think leads to a very optimistic future. But we have to understand it's shades of gray, right? There's an even stronger bull case where there's like a sandbox for DeFi experimentation because we want this industry to thrive in the US. And there's safeguards for certain types of stablecoins because we want private dollar-based stablecoins to thrive in that space. And that, you're going to see the greatest VC investment boom in crypto that you've ever seen. There's also a worst-case scenario, which is that overreach and a long legal pathway to decision-making. And that's just a risk you take when you invest in a market that has the potential to, you know, 10x more in the near term if you get the right outcome. You have to take on risk to have that reward, and that's definitely true in the DeFi space.
I was looking at your guys' DeFi holdings, and you've got your work cut out for you, especially if you spend too much time on Twitter, because I'm sure you get a lot of people tweeting at you to include different things. But my question for you, Matt, is how do you actually decide what goes into your DeFi index? Like, so a more targeted question. You have Uniswap, Aave, like this is, I'm looking at something from February where it's Uniswap, Aave, Synthetics, Maker, Compound, UMA, Yearn, and Loop here. And so like there's no SushiSwap, there's no Chainlink. How do you actually make those decisions?
It's a great question. Sushi's now in the index in the updated version. There are two steps to it. One, there are a bunch of screens that screen out risks that we think are binary risks. Examples of that, Jason, we have an institutional audience. If you can't custody an asset at a regulated custodian with insurance in place, we can't have it in our index and our fund. So that's like a simple rule. So something like Sushi, I think in February, there were no institutional custodians that would custody it. They often take a few months to catch up to new assets, and that's my guess what was going on there. So there are a couple of those binary screens where we just can't hold something. If you can't custody it, if it's not liquid, if it hasn't been on the market long enough, if it's at risk of being deemed a security. So there are these binary screens in there that screen out a handful of assets. Other assets like Chainlink is a great example and an edge case that we debated a lot. The criteria for what makes something a DeFi asset from our perspective is if it is going after a market that is a traditional financial services market. In other words, like a business line of a company that's in a financial services ETF. So what a traditional financial investor would think of as a financial services business. Chainlink's one we debated a lot. It's definitely an edge case. The closest analogy we could think of for what Chainlink is a company like Thomson Reuters. Thomson Reuters is a big information and data provider. People use it as a reference point for getting prices in the traditional financial services space, somewhat similar to how people use Chainlink as an oracle to access real-world information. Thomson Reuters is not a financials company. So in the traditional financial world, Thomson Reuters is classified in a different industry. I believe it's in the industrials group. And so it didn't make it into the index because it's not a traditional financial services business per se. It's still an important part of the ecosystem. It's in our Bitwise 10 index. We're fans. It just didn't quite make it in from that traditional financial worldview of what is the financial services business that DeFi is supposed to disrupt. Chainlink is disrupting and something else and playing a slightly different role.
Outside of the regulatory side of things, what's kind of keeping you up at night? Like, what are, either from a worried point of view or just an excited point of view, like, what is your like big thought that you're noodling on these days?
Yeah, two things. One thing that's always true of me in the crypto space is I feel like I'm living like a year ahead. So I'm so fundamentally bullish on where we are in crypto right now with what's going on with Bitcoin and ETF stuff, with Ethereum and the development there, with DeFi space, that I think the market should be a year ahead of where it is today. And so it's frustrating me to watch us churn sideways over the past few months. That's what gets me excited, though, is my degree of conviction in crypto is higher today than it ever has been in the past. And so I just love watching it happen. What keeps me up at night is all behavioral issues. My job as CIO is to help investors allocate to this space. The biggest risk I see for investors allocating to this space is that they panic and sell at the next market dip, or conversely, that they chase high returns. So I spend a lot of my time trying to convince people that this is a 3-5 year holding, because I think that that conviction and that long-term orientation will determine if they're successful or not. And so I spend all my time worrying about, will people panic sell at the wrong time? That's what keeps me up at night. What about you? Let me flip the interview. What are you most excited about over the next 6 months or a year in crypto land?
I would say micro. I'm incredibly excited about Blockworks. Blockworks is going from 10 employees to start the year to nearly 40 at the end of the year. We're launching new podcasts, new newsletters. We just launched a 5,000 person DeFi conference, semi thanks to you. So we appreciate all your guidance there as one of our advisors. And I'm like, Blockworks is, I truly believe, one of the most exciting companies to work at, not just in crypto, but in the whole US or in the world right now. Like, there's just so much momentum behind the company. On a macro scale, I don't mean to be lame with this answer, but I would kind of copy you. Like, I feel like I have so much conviction, and I feel like, just having been in the industry for a while, it's you can start to see the future and what it looks like. And I'm kind of just waiting for everything else to keep up. And I will say, it's not just you and me. It feels like a lot of folks who have been in the industry, and especially who saw 2017, it feels like we can start to see what 2022 and maybe even 2023 might look like. And I'm just excited waiting for things to catch up to that vision. And all the while, just trying to get as many friends and family members on board before this next run up happens. So I'm having a great time. I'm happy and I'm excited. So things are good.
I love it. I love it. Agree with all that.
Matt, you guys are what? Bitwiseinvestments.com?
Bitwiseinvestments.com. Find me on Twitter, Matt_Hogan, H-O-U-G-A-N. It's got that U in there to throw you off. But and then see me at the next Blockworks event for sure.
Amazing. Appreciate the plug. All right, Matt. Have a great day.
Thanks, Jason.